There's a saying that goes, a good book is the best of friends, the same today and forever. But books that are periodically revised can be even better. Consider the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, the catalog of mind-based maladies designated by the American Psychiatric Association. Plagued by fears or fantasies, bad thoughts or bad behaviors, if the problem's in your head, it's in the DSM, charting your psychic pain since 1952. The next edition, the fifth in 60 years, isn't due out until 2012, but now's the time when new disorders are debated, tested, and prepped for their debuts in the DSM-5. The world consults this book. This is a very big deal.
Because the disorder definitions that we provide are used by the FDA to determine whether or not a new medication might have an indication for treatment.
Dr. Daryl Regeer is the vice chair of the DSM-5 task force.
It's used by the NIH to assess the type of disorder that somebody is asking to research. It's also used by Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies to identify the condition that somebody is requesting payment of treatment for.
Most important, it's used by doctors to define what's normal and what's not. It was the DSM that officially declared homosexuality a mental disorder, and then in 1973, officially undeclared it. It's defined an ever-expanding range of phobias and addictions that we're still arguing about, but this time, demands for more transparency aim to crack open the window on DSM deliberations, so interested parties can weigh in before they are enshrined. Because once they are, the FDA approves drugs to treat them, and any further debate is drowned out in the flood of direct-to-consumer ads.
If you are one of the many who suffer from overwhelming anxiety and intense fear of social situations with unfamiliar people,
you know when you're not feeling like yourself. You're tired all the time. You may feel sad, hopeless, and lose interest in things you once loved. You may feel anxious.
You can feel it in so many ways. Cymbalta can help. Cymbalta is a prescription medication that treats many symptoms of depression.
One controversial diagnosis up for inclusion is gender identity disorder. For social conservatives and some religious groups, this is a definite thumbs up for inclusion in the DSM. If you think you're a woman trapped in a man's body or vice versa, you have a disorder. But Dr. Michael First, who worked on the last two editions of the DSM, says that for those in the transgender community, it's not so simple.
People who want sex reassignment surgery, people who are transgendered so much so that they feel like they have to go all the way and actually change their gender, they need to view this as a disorder in order to qualify for the surgery.
You mean to get insurance to cover it?
Insurance and also social acceptance. The people who are against it are people who see being transgendered as a lifestyle choice and part of the normal variation, and they just see the stigma.
Similarly, feminists stand on both sides of the debate over a form of PMS affecting 5% of menstruating women that is so severe it impairs their ability to function. It's called PMDD, or
premenstrual dysphoric disorder, a distinct medical condition. It causes intense mood and physical symptoms right before your period. Doctors can now treat PMDD with Serafem, the first and only prescription medication for PMDD.
When the Serafem commercials came out was when I got, you know, the aha.
Steph Prose was being treated for depression, even though she rejected that diagnosis and felt stigmatized by it. When she saw the Serafem ad depicting her debilitating mood swings, her rages, and her guilt, she finally felt she had a real diagnosis and was deeply relieved and grateful.
Somebody knows actually what I'm talking about. And immediately I called my doctor and said, this is what I have. I want depression taken off the record.
Like so much in the DSM, diagnosis is a judgment call. But Steph Prose, who now blogs about PMDD at lifewpmdd.com, has no trouble passing judgment on whether it should be in the DSM.
My answer is yes. Trying to go to work every day and getting the energy to do it, it does. It affects you every single day. And to me, that is a disorder.
PMDD has languished in the appendix of the DSM, signifying that the jury is still out. It is a hot-button issue because, you know, this one's just for the ladies, and it could be used against them, all of them. But the political ramifications don't worry Steph Prose.
hadn't really thought about it. I guess the way I look at it is kind of a sexist disease.
Serafem, just Prozac and Pink, is still available, but the FDA demanded that Eli Lilly pull the ads because they described the symptoms of PMDD so broadly, they were virtually indistinguishable from what most women experience as PMS, a condition not currently up for inclusion in the DSM.
If we're in the business of treating PMS with psychiatric drugs, in part what we're saying is that there is a level of insanity to the suffering of PMS.
Jonathan Metzl, psychiatrist and author of Prozac on the Couch, Prescribing Gender in the Era of Wonder Drugs.
Historically speaking, psychiatric drugs have been used to convey the message that if you're not just suffering from an illness, but if you are not a good mother, if you are not a good wife, these are all conditions that can be treated with psychiatric medications. And I can say that historically, the blurriness of that line has gotten psychiatry into a lot of trouble. The mother's little helper phenomenon in the 70s is one example of that.
Valium.
Correct. We know that when the industry drives diagnosis, there's a process that happens that Peter Kramer, in listening to Prozac, beautifully described as diagnostic bracket creep. People start to come into doctors' offices and say, I know this drug is indicated for a particular illness, but I've kind of got that. And the doctor says, that sounds good enough. We'll give you this medication. And what happens over time is that the diagnostic boundaries expand and expand and expand, so that a drug that was indicated for a very small subset of people over time becomes indicated and used for a much wider category.
50% of the population defines itself as shy.
Christopher Lane is the author of Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness.
Enormous number of people have a profound dislike of speaking in public, but that doesn't mean they suffer from a psychiatric condition. And the effort on the part of these psychiatrists and the APA to broaden the net and include internet addiction and compulsive buying disorder and apathy disorder, relational disorder, all of these are basically codes for everyday experiences and fears and anxieties that should not be represented in a psychiatric Bible.
Lane says the media compound the problem by reporting only the upper range of the estimate of those who may suffer from a potential disorder, and by failing to report the size of the field studies, which often are quite small.
I mean, one of the studies, it was a telephone survey to 526 urban Canadians, came out with self-reported accounts of social anxiety that ranged from 1.9% to 18.7%. But only the higher figure was reported in the subsequent media literature. And what happens is then the public reads that or hears it on the radio and decides this is potentially a problem, certainly with social anxiety disorder, because the drug maker in question, GlaxoSmithKline, spent over $94 million on what it called a public awareness campaign for the disorder in question. It wanted people basically to rethink whether they were suffering from just shyness and to ask themselves whether it might be something more serious like social anxiety disorder.
The issue with all mental disorders is they're defined in terms of symptoms that we all experience every day as part of normal living.
Dr. Michael First, who worked on the third DSM and was an editor on the fourth.
Sadness, anxiety, palpitations, these are all normal phenomenon. It's only when they're sufficiently severe enough and cluster together that they begin to look like they're a potential mental disorder. So if you add a mental disorder to the DSM and it's defined in terms of everyday symptoms, you always run the risk of labeling someone who is normal with having a disorder.
The DSM task force is keenly aware of the risk of what are called false positives, a risk driven home in 1972 by psychologist David Rosenhan, who conducted a study in which 8 mentally healthy people gained admission to 12 psychiatric hospitals in 5 states by claiming to hear a voice saying empty or hollow or thud. That was their only deception. Otherwise, they behaved normally. All but one was diagnosed as schizophrenic. After admission, they said they felt fine and their behavior reflected it, but it took them from 7 to 52 days to be discharged with a diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. When the study was published, 2 psychiatric hospitals agreed to undergo the same test. Could they identify the fakers? In fact, they identified dozens of them. Only none had actually been sent.
One of the big challenges of psychiatric diagnosis is the fact that it's still descriptive. It's based upon the way patients present.
Is this why we're all desperate for genetics to come up with, hey, you have a super short, you know, Q gene, therefore that's the cause of your condition?
We're desperate for that. It's never going to happen, I think. The reason why we haven't discovered the gene for schizophrenia is there is no gene for schizophrenia. It's a complex interaction of so many different factors. I would have imagined that after 15 years of research, given all of the advances, we'd have to have a lab test by now. And in fact, there was a series of research conferences before work on DSM-5 actually started. And one question that was put to every single research group is, are we ready to have lab tests or genes or neuroimaging as a diagnostic test? And every single time that question was raised, we always got the same answer, which is, while this is interesting, while there's data, it's not good enough to help us make a diagnosis. So we're going to have to wait till, you know, who knows when, but certainly not now.
So diagnosis is still an art.
Still an art. But it's also an art in the rest of medicine as well. I think anyone who's ever had back pain or an ill-defined medical illness will see how similar the rest of medicine can be to psychiatry.
Similar, but not the same. First concedes that the diagnoses of medical disorders rarely affect the culture as intensely as mental disorders do.
The DSM is an amalgam of social values and the science. I think the decisions made by the people in the DSM have direct impact on everyone.
That's why this veteran of DSM 3 and 4 stands with the many DSM critics who are calling for more public deliberations.
You want to see, how did this group of individuals who are making these decisions come up with their decisions? And more importantly, you want to have advanced warning so that if a proposal starts pushing its way through, people are aware of what that proposal is, and if they see a problem with it, they'll write in and say, you know, you haven't considered this. It's the interaction and the give and take with the entire both scientific community and the community at large which could produce the best DSM. That's the big problem with not having full transparency. It really robs the book of very, very important input at the earliest possible stages.
The DSM website offers some updates, but no details of the closed-door deliberations over proposed disorders. What's more, members of the task force sign a contract pledging not to divulge any confidential information, defined as, quote, all work product, unpublished manuscripts and drafts, and other pre-publication materials, group discussions, internal correspondence, information about the development process, and any other written or unwritten information in any form that emanates from or relates to my work with the APA task force or work group. Not exactly the model of transparency. Dr. Darrell Regeer, vice chair of the current DSM-5 task force.
This particular section was written by the intellectual property attorneys, and their concerns were that individuals who have inside access to the entire process don't use this for personal gain.
Nevertheless, Regeer does disagree with the critics. He believes it's best that raw data, rough drafts, and internal discussions stay behind closed doors.
Otherwise, it would just be cacophony and mass confusion.
I think that some of them wouldn't mind what you call cacophony in order to be able to have some input into the process before it is so well underway.
Well, it has been underway since 1999, and we put up in 2004 the DSM5.org website where people could provide their input. And in fact, we've had quite a bit of input coming in from the general public. The general public actually doesn't get that involved until it's clear what the disorders are and what the impact might be.
That's because they don't know what is under consideration.
Well, I think that you've seen a number of presentations in the press of people speculating about what might be under consideration.
Do you ever personally wonder that too much of the wide range of human behavior is being pathologized?
I worry about that a lot. And when I went into the field of psychiatric epidemiology, which is my research area, I was very concerned that in 1950s there was a book out called Midtown Manhattan Study that identified something like 84% of folks in Manhattan as having a mental disorder. So I've been concerned since that time of having something that is certainly much more credible. I think the DSM three criteria enabled us to narrow down on what is really a disorder and what is within the normal range of human, you know, emotional expression.
I think if you took the wide swath of depression disorders that are in the DSM and add them to the wide swath of anxiety disorders that are in the DSM and throw in quite a few of the attention disorders that are in the DSM, you could easily find that 84% of New Yorkers have a mental disorder.
I don't think you can.
Let's assume that the only goal of the DSM is to reduce the sum of human suffering. Under consideration for inclusion in the Global Compendium of Psychic Pain include apathy disorder, compulsive shopping disorder, relational disorder, internet addiction, and binge eating. Who among us cannot find ourselves somewhere in the DSM? Which prompts the question, not how much suffering is too much, we know mental illness destroys lives, but how much suffering is too little? Psychiatry has lowered our threshold for pain, and it's raised the bar for normal. Maybe the expectation that there is a normal is the most insidious disorder of all.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Preetschap and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Happy New Year, Bob.
Happy New Year, Brookie.
Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.